It's New Year's Day, the day we start living by our New Year's resolutions. The trouble is, surveys show 95% of us won't make it to Groundhog Day. Hi, I'm Rob West. That doesn't stop most of us from making New Year's resolutions, hoping this time will be different. Well, I have some ways to help you achieve your goals this time. Then we have lots of great listener questions ahead, but we won't be taking your live calls today because this program is pre-recorded. This is Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. Well, surveys show that the majority of us still make New Year's resolutions, but only about 8% of us stick to them for a whole year. Have you ever wondered why so many people make resolutions and so few keep them? Well, I think the reason for them is hope. We hope we can make our lives better with these improvements, and the failure rate is high because, even though many of these resolutions sound simple, like lose weight, they require fundamental changes in lifestyle. So what are the top New Year's resolutions? Well, there really aren't any surprises there. A survey of 2,000 people showed that going on a diet is still number one with 71%, followed by exercise more at 65%. If you're wondering where money comes into the picture, it's not far behind. Save more or spend less came in fourth at 32%. After that, we resolved to learn a new skill, quit smoking, find another job, and spend more time with family and friends. So pretty much what you'd expect. And all of those are worthy resolutions, good things to strive for in life, and it's fine for believers to want those life improvements. But there are other resolutions that Christians should make that will help them achieve greater success and all the rest. These Christian New Year's resolutions should focus on God and fulfilling His will, not yours. If a resolution honors Him, for example, He's more likely to empower you to achieve it. So these Christian resolutions should come first, or be in addition to things like quitting smoking and going to the gym. Here are some examples. A great place to start is by asking for guidance on what resolutions God would like you to make. James 1:5 says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given you." Then, resolve to pray daily for the wisdom and strength to keep the resolutions you feel God is leading you to make. We know that God works through people, so resolve to be accountable to another person for sticking to your resolutions. That can be a two-way street, with you helping to keep the other person accountable too. If you keep the resolutions we've talked about so far, seeking God's will, praying for wisdom and strength, and making yourself accountable, you'll probably start to see success fairly quickly, and you might start feeling pretty good about yourself. That's where our next Christian New Year's resolution comes in. Resolve not to take the credit for that success. Philippians 4:13 says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Keep in mind that it's God empowering you to achieve success with your resolutions. And you'll still experience setbacks along the way, but knowing that God is with you will make it much easier to get back on track. And let's not forget some of the other New Year's resolutions that Christians should make, things like reading the entire Bible during the year, or praying more, or giving more to your church and other ministries. Those are all very good indeed, and we should all want to achieve them. But make sure you're doing them for the right reason. Many fall short on these spiritual resolutions because they're doing them for the wrong person, to make themselves look good. In Matthew 6:5, Jesus tells us, "When you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward." Instead, our motivation should be to honor God, or the desire to grow closer to Him, or become more like Christ. You see, when you make a resolution, acknowledge that you'll only be able to keep it with God's help and that He deserves all the credit. Ephesians 2:10 reads, "For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand, that we should walk in them." So, it's January 1st, New Year's Day. You still have time to make a few more resolutions that honor God and seek His help in keeping all the rest. We'd love for you to let us know how it's going along the way, and we trust that as you do this, you'll see 2024 as a year where you've grown closer to God and become more like Christ. As I said, we're off today, so don't call in, but we've got some great calls lined up in advance, so we'll go to those just around the corner. I'm Rob West, and we'll be right back. Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. Our team is not here today, so let me just remind you not to call in, but I will also remind you that we have some great questions that we lined up in advance, so you're not going to want to miss today's broadcast. Before we head to the phones, though, a quick email. These come to us at askrob@faithfi.com. This one comes to us from Tim. Tim writes, is this an appropriate time to look for a first-time homebuyer loan? The housing prices are so high, the interest rates are high as well. We have about $35,000 saved for a down payment, but we're not sure what to do. And Tim, it really is a challenging time to buy a home. We've got interest rates that have more than doubled in the last 3 years. We've got housing prices that are up. Average home now over $400,000 instead of $300,000 where they were 3 years ago. So I would say let's not rush into it. Make sure you save for that down payment. That $35,000 at 20% down would only buy you a $175,000 home. If that fits your needs, great. If it doesn't, I'd say wait. The interest rates will come down and you can continue to save. I hope that helps. This one comes from a curious parent. Anonymous writes, what kind of credit card would be good for a 14-year-old? One that money can be put on and there is a limit. Is there any reputable company that offers one? Well, let me just say, first of all, thanks for writing. You must be 18 to get a credit card in your own name. And that's true even for a secured credit card. This is because the credit card agreement is a legal contract. However, you can make a child an authorized user on your credit card as early as age 13. This would help the youngster build a credit history, but it won't teach responsibility because you'll be managing the card. Many banks, however, will allow a child to get a debit card as young as 13 to use with either a joint checking account that's also in your name, or it could be with a custodial account in the child's name. The child will manage the account and would give them a great opportunity with your supervision to learn responsibility. You could go to bankrate.com and search for the bank programs that are the best right now. We happen to use the Capital One Money account with our kids right now, but there's a lot of great ones out there. But I think the key is a debit card is the way to go. Now, use this as an opportunity to help them develop a spending plan, understand that money is limited and it needs to be used among the save, grow, and give categories. We also want to take it as an opportunity to teach the biblical basis for handling money, starting with the idea that God owns it all and recognizing that we're stewards or money managers for the Lord's resources. But this could be a great opportunity for you to do some instruction and set them up for success as they prepare to be future adults managing their own money. So thank you for writing to us. By the way, if you have a question, you'd like us to read it on the air, send it along to askrob@faithfi.com. We'd love to tackle it. All right, let's dive in. We're going to begin in Florida today. Hi, Zed. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. The question that I have is, I have a business that's operating since 2003. I have a 20-year business that does me very well. I'm doing over $100,000 a year with the business.
Yeah.
But I am on the age to retire, 62. So what I was thinking to do is to move the business to my wife's, under my wife's management, even though I was going to be working with her, and get retirement through the Social Security. And I don't know if it would be a good idea to do that or not.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of things going on here. I mean, there's obviously the financial considerations, and we can talk about, at least on a high level, some of those considerations today. And, you know, this doesn't replace you doing some real financial planning with a competent financial planner who can look at retirement and all the other aspects of your financial life. But we can at least get started today. But then there's the non-financial side as well, which is, you know, our calling doesn't have an expiration from the Lord. You've been gifted with certain skills and abilities to be in service to the Lord until He calls you home. And so we don't want to retire from something. I think we want to retire to something. So I think really seeking the Lord in prayer and saying, what do you have for me during this next season of life? How can I best be used in service to you and to others around me? And is that right here in this business, this platform that you've given me to impact your suppliers and vendors and customers and all the people you interact with? Or is it something else entirely? And, you know, I would love for you to have a plan for that before you enter retirement. And all of a sudden now, you know, you're wondering what you're going to do with your time. Let's go back to the financial piece for a second. You asked about retirement related to taking Social Security early. We generally don't recommend that unless somebody's in a real difficult situation and they just need the money. And I'm not hearing you say that. The reason is that's going to lock in about a 30% reduction in benefits for the rest of your life. So you get that annual benefit statement from Social Security, and they've been estimating based on your work record what your Social Security benefits will be at full retirement age. Well, that's either 66 or 67. But if you're to take it at 62, that number that they've been estimating is, you know, going to be about 30% lower. And so, you know, if you can delay that at least until full retirement age, that would be good. And perhaps even until age 70. And given that you're planning to continue to work in the business anyway, whether, you know, you're taking the lead on managing it or your wife is, if you don't need that money, you're not going to get that 8% guaranteed increase anywhere else. You're certainly not going to get that in the stock market. And so I would encourage you to hold off unless there's some other compelling reason for you to take it early. Does that all make sense, though?
It does make sense. A lot of it. That's why I called, because I was so unsure what to do.
Yeah, yeah, very good. So talk to me just about, you know, what's causing you to want to make a change just in terms of how you and your wife are currently managing the business, and this idea that you would, you know, consider retiring even though you really don't want to leave, you know, your work. What's going on behind the scenes there?
Well, we have 4 real estate properties that are rented. I have mortgage on all of them, but all of them have a lot of equity, and we get some passive income through them.
Yeah.
And if I retired, I would get additional money from the Social Security, which could just get us doing pretty good. And my wife could take over the business. The income would be under her name. The money would come anyway, but under her name, I don't know if that would make a difference or not, because we file together as husband and wife.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter who kind of takes the lead. It's really about just kind of the division of the labor. So the business you're describing, is the business actually running these rental properties, or is it something else and you have the rental properties on top of it?
It's the commercial properties. And personally, we have 2 other properties under our names.
Okay. So the business is real estate, operating this real estate, correct?
Yeah, it's a computer business, technical business. But the business itself owns 2 warehouses that we rent out.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Well, you know, I mean, you know your business well, you know kind of how you want to handle things moving forward. You know, it's really less about the tax implications in this case, because again, as you said, if you're married filing jointly, income to you and or your wife is income. So it doesn't really matter who's getting it. I think the key is, how do you want to spend your time in this season of life? How much do you want to work? How much does she want to work? But, you know, given the income sources that you have, it sounds like you're not struggling to pay your bills. So from that standpoint, you know, again, I would really encourage you to consider waiting on taking the Social Security just because you don't need it. And it doesn't sound to me, at least, like you're looking to stop working. You're wanting to continue. You just have the opportunity to take this money, but if you can wait, you're going to get a check 30% higher for the rest of your life, which I think you'll appreciate down the road. I hope that helps. Thanks for your call. We'll be right back. Thanks for joining us on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. All right, let's go to Chicago. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you. You know, everything around the world, they say, you know, pay off your debt and everything's good. I noticed in the last 6 months, and I owe absolutely nothing to anybody, and I pay off my credit cards every month. And I'm a smart guy. I use my credit cards all the time, but I pay off by the time they're due, and I get my 2 or 3% on the credit cards where they say you can. But I noticed my FICO score has been going down in the last year. It went from like 830. I'm down to like 785. And when I click on the button and I say, why is my FICO score going down? It's because it says I don't have any revolving credit.
Right.
So am I getting punished for not being in debt?
Yes, you are. You absolutely are. And that's unfortunately the way the algorithm works, is that the most recent information impacts you the most, and 10% of your score is made up from your credit mix. So what they want to see is that you have active accounts that are across the different credit types. So one credit type is installment loans. That would be a car loan or a mortgage. Another credit type is a revolving account. That's what you're seeing there. That would be most often a credit card, whether that's secured or unsecured. And because you don't have any active accounts, well, you do. You're charging things up and paying them off every month, right? So you do have some active revolving accounts?
I do. I have three or four different credit cards, but I pay them off, you know, like a...
Yeah, you don't get penalized for paying them off. As long as you have active accounts, that, you know, that's the key. You may have had... Have you had one or more accounts that have closed or been paid in full recently?
Maybe 2 years ago, I had a car loan, and that was about it. A couple years ago.
Yeah.
My big concern is... Let's just say I want to go and buy a brand new car and it costs $40,000. And they pull up my FICO score and they say, well, you're not excellent. You're not over 800. You're 785. Am I going to get dinged or questioned, or I'm not going to get the best rate, or do you know?
No, you should be fine, because the key here is as long as you have a score north of between 720 and 740, let's say 740, you're going to be fine. You'll be able to qualify for the very best rates and terms. And you're saying the lowest you've seen your score is 785. So you should be in good shape. You know, when you get up above 740, you really, you know, other than bragging rights, you're not going to do anything to improve your situation, because you're already qualifying for the very best rates and terms. So I wouldn't really worry about it. You know, it might behoove you to go ahead and, which you should do every, you know, couple of times a year anyway, you may want to go ahead and pull a copy of your three credit reports, not your credit score, your three credit reports from TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax, just to make sure there's not any incorrect or erroneous information on them. And the best place to do that, you can access all three at annualcreditreport.com. annualcreditreport.com. Shouldn't cost you anything. And just give them a once over, because there may be something on there that is not right. But apart from that, it's probably just that, you know, you have less active credit going today than you did a couple of years ago. Your score is going to move around anyway. And depending on where you pull it, you may, you know, historically you may have been looking at a FICO score, and maybe now you've pulled it from somewhere that gives the Vantage score. Just two different companies with two different algorithms that generate scores a different way. And so it's not uncommon, depending on where you pull it, that it's going to look different, you know, from one vendor over another. One of them may be looking at a, you know, your TransUnion file, and the other may be looking at your Equifax file, and maybe not all of your accounts are reporting to TransUnion. They're all reporting to Equifax. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, Tim, you're not going to have any problem getting the car loan you want when you go buy that car, unless you get down below probably 730, 720. Okay.
And it shouldn't drop that far.
It really shouldn't. I mean, there's no reason, unless you have a missed payment or something. I'm not hearing anything, especially with you continuing to charge on these accounts and pay them off every month. That's showing active on-time payment history, and, you know, that's the key. So I think you're in pretty good shape. If anything, once you buy the car, you probably will see, after you get beyond just the inquiry, which is going to pull it down, you know, a little bit, but that won't matter because you'll already have the credit, you know, you'll already have the score. You know, by adding that car loan, will probably 6 months after you buy the car, you'll find your scores back up to the high point where it was.
Okay. All right. That was the main thing. Like, when I want to go buy the car, I just want to get the best rate possible.
Yeah. And you will with anything close to what you're saying your score is today.
Great. All right, Rob. Yep. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, Tim. You too, sir. God bless you. 800-525-7000 to stay in Illinois. Hi, Rhonda. Go ahead.
Hi, Rob. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you for, just want to say what a blessing you are first to us and the Ministry of Finance.
That's very kind.
Real quick, a couple of days ago, I was listening and you were talking about whole life versus term. I have a term policy that is going to end in about 12 years. I'm 60 now, so it's going to take me to 72. My insurance agent is talking to me about converting that over to a whole life. But like I said, you had mentioned you weren't a fan of the whole life. So I'm wondering what would be the best route for me to take at this point.
Yeah, it's a great question here, Rhonda, and I want to unpack it, and I don't want to rush it. So let's do this. I've got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll weigh in on this. You know, you can, in many cases, convert that if there's a rider on there that makes it convertible to a whole life policy. The question is, does that make sense, and do you need it? So let's talk about that just around the corner. Talking to Rhonda in Zion, Illinois, about possibly converting term insurance to whole life insurance. Back with much more right around the corner. Stick around. Hey, great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. We're taking your calls and questions today. Looks like all the lines are nearly full, so let's dive right back in. Before the break, we were talking to Rhonda. She called to ask about her term policy. It expires when she's 72. She's 60 now, so 12 years from now. And her advisor, it sounds like, is recommending she consider converting it to a whole life policy, which can be done. It typically would involve a conversion rider, an additional option that you would add to a term life insurance to give you the option to convert some or all of your term life policy to a whole life insurance policy, which would then allow you to extend it, you know, beyond the end of the term. But as I was alluding to, Rhonda, before the break, you know, the question is, do you need life insurance in that season of life? And the reason I recommend generally term insurance is because you cover the risk that exists during your working years. So if you have, typically it's a married couple, one may be the bread earner or winner, or maybe both are working. And if one of you passes away and you're a person that's earning income and the other spouse is depending upon that, then the life insurance should, you know, hopefully come in and cover that so that you can continue to pay your bills, maintain your lifestyle, maybe pay off the house, those kinds of things. But typically, once you get to, in your case, 72, you don't have that risk. If you're married and both still living, then if one of you passes away, there's not a hardship that's created for the other spouse financially because you're living off of Social Security and retirement assets that you've accumulated. So I guess that would be my main question is, what need exists for life insurance at age 72? Is it just so that there's money there for an inheritance or something else?
Well, Rob, I'm going to say first, my husband's going to be glad I called you today. I am married. My husband is the breadwinner of our home. His income is larger than mine. So for me, I really was just, you know, just wanting to leave a little something. He would probably be just fine if I didn't. And he tells me, don't spend your money on insurance, Rhonda. I got you.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the right question to ask is, you know, you're spending a certain amount every month. It's going to be more when you convert it to whole life, and it's going to get more expensive over time. And so the question is, you know, would you all be better off recapturing that money in your budget so you can set it aside and build up emergency savings or give it away? And so rather than you continuing to fund a policy that's getting more and more expensive when there's not a real need for it, I think, you know, that's where if we're, you know, take a step back, we might say, you know what, let's drop that policy. We don't need it anymore. Now, maybe you wait and continue to pay on it until 72 and, you know, I don't know your financial situation, but maybe by 72, the house is paid off and, you know, you're both fully retired and you've got your income sources in place. And so, again, there's no need for this insurance. So that's just one more expense we can eliminate in that season of life. And that could be really helpful, or it could allow you to redirect that money to something else. Does that make sense?
Rob, that makes perfect sense. And I listen very carefully to you about budgeting and saving for emergency funds and things like that. So I'm the money-wise person in the family, and we are definitely implementing all these things that you said. But what you did say was, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What you did say was to maybe go ahead and keep it till I'm 72 when our house is paid off, because at around that age, our house will indeed be paid off, and then there won't be any need for me to continue paying an insurance payment. I can just put that money aside for savings or giving or something like that. So that makes good sense to me.
Well, there you go. Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, I think that does make a lot of sense to me, so long as it continues to fit in the budget. The nice thing about a term insurance policy is it's level term until you reach the end of the term, which in your case is another 12 years. So, you know, as long as it will continue to fit in the budget, you guys may be thrilled, you know, that you know that that's there in case the Lord calls you home, your husband can pay off the house. And, you know, but when we get to that point, we let it go and redirect that money elsewhere. So it sounds like a great plan to me, Rhonda. I appreciate your gift of encouragement today. You've certainly been an encouragement to me, and I appreciate you being on the program. Thanks for being a faithful listener. God bless you. Let's go to Lancaster, Illinois, I guess. Judy, go ahead.
Yes, it's not Lancaster, Illinois. It's Pennsylvania.
Okay, that's what I was thinking here. Go ahead.
Yeah. I had a regular bank savings account. I changed it over. I won't go through the long details of that, but I changed it over to my regular bank or new bank, and it was still just a regular savings account, earning probably 40 cents a month interest.
Okay.
And 6 months ago, they asked me, I went in the bank for some reason, and the teller said, would you like to earn 3 point whatever on your savings? Well, yeah, I guess I would like that.
And, sure.
So for the last 6 months, I didn't know it was a money market account, but that's what they said it was then. And it was 3 point whatever for 6 months. And it was $130, $40, $50 a month. Last month, it was $155. This month, it was $95 and change. And so I called to ask why the drop, and they said, because the percentage dropped, and it's only 1.9 now.
Mm.
So my question is, should I just continue and take, they said it's variable, and should I just go along with whatever happens to show up for the month, or should I change over to CDs or something? There's about a little over $50,000 in there.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I think it really comes down, Judy, to the hassle factor. I mean, are you willing to go through some extra steps in order to get that number up? Because what it sounds like is your bank had a promotional offer that was in place, and that has come and gone, and now it's back down to a rate that's pretty subpar to where interest rates are today. You know, I'm looking at bankrate.com right now at, you know, high yield savings, meaning it's not a CD, it's a savings account with zero fees and zero minimums, from Capital One, American Express, Marcus, which is the retail operation of Goldman Sachs, Barclays. All of them are 4.3 and higher right now, with, again, no minimums, no fees. And so, you know, on $50,000, you know, you could be earning $2,150 a year or $180 a month. But what that would mean is you'd have to go out and open a high-yield savings account with one of these at Bankrate.com and then link it electronically to your checking account. And then you could move the money back and forth on their website without any fees whatsoever through the ACH system. That's what I would do, but it does require for you to have one extra account that you have to keep up with. But if you go with one of those online institutions that I mentioned, they're pretty aggressive about keeping the rates up where they should be at the high end of the range, which today is 4.3% for savings. Stay on the line. You and I will talk a bit more off the air. We'll be right back. Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance. We're taking your calls and questions today. In fact, we've got so many calls, we're going to do our best to get through them today. Let's go right back to the phones, to Orlando, Florida. Hi, Rick. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. I've been listening to your program, and I've heard you say that if you've been retired and you're taking Social Security, it's based on, I think you said, the last 30 years of your life or something like that, but if you go back to work and you're earning more money, that some of those lower years can be dropped off and your Social Security benefit will be recalculated to a higher rate. Does that happen automatically, or is that something that I have to go do?
No, it's automatic. So every year they'll take a look at your earnings record, and if you're continuing to work, paying FICA taxes, and your earnings for the current year replace one of your high 35, it's your 35 highest years of earnings, then your benefit will automatically be recalculated.
Okay, so I don't have to do anything, just wait for the money to roll in.
That's exactly right. So you're buying coffee, Rick, next time, and I'm in Orlando, okay? Since your check's going up.
Not a problem. Come on right down. We'll get a cup. I'll even buy you a donut to go with it.
Hey, what do you know? Wow. I love it. All right. Hey, thanks, my friend. Thanks for being on the program today. We appreciate it. Let's go back to Chicago. Hey, Sue, what can I do for you?
I'm 65, and I've got a little bit of a work record, so I've earned Social Security, you know, on that record. My husband's 62. My question is, if I took Social Security early at, you know, at the age of 65, and then if he took his, you know, at full retirement age for him, and I bumped up to half of his, would my half be smaller because I started taking mine at an earlier, you know, before my full retirement age?
Yeah. No. So you could take yours and then wait. And once you switch to his, you would get whatever you're entitled to on his at that time that you take it. And at any point, you're allowed to switch to the one that's higher. So you're only locking the benefit in based on the one that you start taking. So in the case where you're collecting based on your earnings record, that one's locked in depending on when you take it, early, full retirement age, all the way to age 70, whatever you choose. But it, you know, that doesn't lock in your spousal benefit until you were to switch over to that one and start taking that benefit.
So I'd get a full 50% of, say he retires and starts taking it at full retirement age or even to 70. When I would bump up, my half would not be impacted at all. by the fact that I took mine earlier.
No, like, what would your age be, though, at that point? Would you be at full retirement age when he starts taking his?
Yeah, because I'm old. You know, I'm 65. He's 62. So if you
Yeah. Absolutely. So you at that point, you could reevaluate and say, is the 50% of his spousal benefit more than what I'm collecting on my work record? And you're right. If you're beyond full retirement age, you know, then you could lock in that full benefit potentially.
Okay. But so that, I guess that my question is, you know, I'm 65, so my full retirement age is almost 67, I think 66 and 9 months or something like that. So if I don't say I don't wait till my own full retirement and start taking, you know, a little bit early, I just wonder if I'm leaving money on the table is the idea. Like I could be taking mine now.
Yeah. Yeah. Potentially you are. I think the question is, will your full benefit based on your work record be less than your spousal benefit, 50% of his? Do you know the answer to that?
Yes, it will be. Yep. It will be about, I don't know, $300 or $400 less.
Your spousal benefits more?
Yes, his will. Yes, my own work record yields a smaller rate than half of his.
Yeah. So what you could do is start taking yours now and just collect, and then wait and switch over to the spousal benefit down the road.
Okay. Yeah, I just wondered if because I took mine early, if me taking mine early.
No.
Like caused me to have a deduction in 50% of his. So
no, okay. It's only based on when you start taking that spousal benefit.
Okay. So, I mean, he's okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Sue, thanks for calling. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Very
thank
much.
You.
Absolutely. To Texas. Hi, Hector. Go ahead.
Hi, good, sir. Thank you for taking my call. Hey,
sure.
So I got a simple call. Anyway, I have a 20-year-old girl. She doesn't have any credit. I was thinking about taking her with me to the furniture place and just take out some furniture that we was going to buy anyway. And, of course, I'm going to make the payments. But would that help her to establish her credit, or is there a better way?
Yeah, so you're looking at she's buying a car. Is that right?
No, I'm going to buy some furniture. But
I was furniture, my apologies.
Under her name. Just so she can start to get some credit, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And are you planning to pay for the furniture anyway?
Yes. Yeah.
And is there, is it like a 0% for a period of time or something?
Oh, no. Well, no, I don't think so, no.
Okay, because I'd rather you not go into debt pay interest in order to build her credit. There's other ways to do it. You could, number one, you could add her as an authorized user to an existing account that you have, and that history will start passing over to her file as well. Now, keep in mind, the good on-time payment history will pass over with her as an authorized user on one of your accounts, even if you don't give her the card and she can't charge on it. But negative information will go as well. So if you happen to miss a payment along the way, that will hurt her credit. So you just got to be careful there. She could open her own card, perhaps a secured credit card. She could go to bankrate.com, nerdwallet.com, find out who has the best secured credit cards right now. She puts $200 or $300 or $400 on deposit. They give her a limit up to it. Maybe she has a budgeted item that she pays every month. Maybe it's a media subscription to a streaming service or something. Maybe it's $12 a month. It hits the card. She pays it off. She doesn't pay a dime in interest, but it's reported to her credit bureau or maybe all three that she's an on-time payer. That will start to build her credit. So I don't want you to take a loan on this furniture and start paying interest just so you can build her credit when there's other ways to do it. Does that make sense?
Sorry? But it makes sense. That I was going to purchase the furniture anyway.
Right, but if you're going to pay cash, so you were going to borrow either way.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. They're going to want you to probably co-sign it because she probably doesn't have a whole lot of credit. So they're going to want to put it in both of your names. You certainly could do that. I think the authorized user or the secured card in her name only might be a better option. But yeah, if you're going to borrow the money anyway for the furniture, because you don't have the money. I guess the only other thought I would share with you is this a time to wait and try to save up so you can pay with cash. But if you need it and you were planning to borrow it, you can service the debt, then yeah, you could certainly add her to the account and that would start to report over. The only maybe final consideration here is that a lot of times these furniture companies will use finance companies that are not considered top tier lenders. And they look at that when they're determining your credit score. So that's not going to help her as much as, let's say, you had a credit card with a top tier bank. I'll pick one, Bank of America, and you add her as an authorized user. That would do more for her than her having a finance company, which is typically what's behind a lot of these furniture companies, buy now, pay later kind of thing. So I might try to avoid that one just because that's not going to be very good for her to show up on her credit file versus another type of account. Thanks for your call today. We appreciate it. Let's see quickly to Grand Rapids. Hi, Penny. Go ahead.
Hey, Rob, I was thinking of buying a car and I know, money people don't want to think you should buy brand new cars, but the used car, $5,000 or $6,000.
Looks like we're losing you. So let's see if you can get you to a better spot and maybe try one more time. You said people usually recommend new. Pick up from there and go ahead.
Yeah, people usually don't recommend new cars. People like you, but used cars are so expensive right now.
Yes,
and they're only like $5,000 or $6,000 less. The ones that were looked like a 2-year-old car.
Yeah.
So do you recommend still buying used or would you go ahead and buy new?
No, it's a great question. I think, historically in a normal environment, you're going to get much more bang for your buck with a used car because, you'd buy a 3-year-old car, you'd miss the prime depreciation years and you get, a better value for still a low mileage car, but you're buying it, 20, 30% below the sticker price. This is an unusual environment, which you're pointing out correctly, where, used cars were through the roof. They've certainly come down this year, but they're still elevated. And I think for that reason, especially as the new car inventories are building, and they're starting to offer more incentives because they have inventory. So you're starting to see commercials that you weren't seeing before with, 0% financing or 2% financing. You're seeing, rebates that you weren't seeing before. So I think for that reason, it can make sense to buy new. I think the key is just first start with your budget and make sure you're buying what you can afford. And then second, start comparing, pick the car that you want that fits the budget, and then start asking the question, does it make more sense to buy new? And what you may find is there's not enough of a benefit to buy used for what you're giving up by having a full, 3 years or 5 years of warranty. So I think you're exactly right. Let's put new cars on the table. Let's start with your budget, but I wouldn't automatically exclude new cars just because they're new. It's a great question, Penny. Thanks for your call. Well, thanks for listening and for calling today. We covered a lot of ground. Above all else, I hope that we've been an encouragement to you and pointed you back to Scripture, because that's really what it's all about. Hey, thanks to my team today, Robert Sutherland, Robert Youngblood, and Devin Patrick. For those gentlemen, I'm Rob West. This has been Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. May God bless you, and we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.